Today is Wednesday, May 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, North Korea is threatening to cancel the Trump-Kim summit.
I don't think Kim Jong-un is going to take anything from President Trump on faith. Both sides are going to have to prove that they're serious.
The international community expresses outrage over violence in Gaza. European nations are trying to salvage the Iran nuclear deal. Also ahead, Britain is in celebration mode with the royal wedding just days away. It's all on today's International Edition. North Korea has canceled Wednesday's high-level talks with the South and says the U.S. will have to undertake careful deliberations about the fate of the upcoming summit between Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump because of joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises. It also complained of what it called the one-sided demand for denuclearization. Pyongyang's state-run news agency said the Max Thunder exercises are a, quote, rehearsal for invasion of North Korea and a provocation, despite what appears to have been warming ties between the North and South. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert pointed out that Kim has said he understands and appreciates the importance of such exercises to the U.S.
Kim Jong-un had said that he understands the importance to the United States that we conduct these joint exercises. These joint exercises continue to go on.
She says as of now, the U.S. is still going ahead with plans for the summit with Kim. But apparently North Korea is threatening to, says it does not want to promise it won't have nuclear weapons. Joining us now to talk about these developments is Frank Januzzi, president of the Mansfield Foundation, which promotes cooperation and understanding between the people of the U.S. and East Asia. What's your reaction to Tuesday's developments with North Korea?
The North Koreans have never liked U.S. military exercises on the peninsula, and some of them they find more threatening than others, especially those that involve anything that could be construed as an offensive military exercise. And I think what we're seeing here is the North Koreans beginning to realize that if they are going to take certain steps, such as suspending missile tests and nuclear tests during this period of dialogue that follows the Olympic peace, that they should demand that the U.S. and South Korea also take steps to create what they would call the right atmosphere for talks. So this is bargaining behavior, and the United States better get used to it because there's going to be more of it to come.
It's my understanding, though, that North Korea had initially said that they were okay with these exercises continuing.
Those were some earlier exercises. The South Koreans explained to the North Koreans a couple of months ago that some of the exercises that had been suspended, full eagle exercises during the Olympics, not suspended but essentially postponed, would go ahead and take place anyway, and those exercises did take place in April, and they did not draw much commentary from the North. These more recent exercises were not, as far as I know, specifically addressed by the South Koreans at the time that they met with the North, and this may be an instance where the Korean People's Army may be saying to the leader Kim Jong-un, hey look, we should be protesting these actions. This is not consistent with the spirit of dialogue that you have tried to create. That they believe that they are showing restraint, and they believe the U.S. and South Korea should similarly create an atmosphere conducive to dialogue.
We also just heard about 24 hours earlier that North Korea was starting to dismantle one of its nuclear facilities.
Correct. I think the North understands that in order to prove their bona fides, in order to try to establish some credibility that they might someday be willing to denuclearize, that they should take certain concrete steps. And one of those steps would be closing their nuclear test site at Punggye-ri. According to Chinese geologists, the Punggye-ri nuclear test facility may be, and I emphasize may be, compromised geologically and no longer be suitable for testing. American geologists have a different opinion. They think that one or two of the tunnels may be compromised, but one or two other tunnels may still be safe for testing. But in any event, the North has already tested a bomb 10 times as powerful as Hiroshima, and probably is satisfied that they don't need to conduct more testing. And so this is a concrete step to try to show goodwill. It's normal bargaining behavior for the North Koreans to mix one gesture that seems conciliatory, such as closing Pyongyang-ri, and another gesture that seems more demanding, such as objecting to the conventional military exercises and threatening to cancel dialogue if the United States does not show greater respect for the North Koreans.
Do you think that with all the money and effort and time that North Korea has spent developing these weapons, that they would be that quick to give them up?
They're not being quick to give them up. They haven't given them up, and any process that might eventually lead to their giving them up would almost certainly be a very long process indeed. Do I think that there are conditions under which the North might denuclearize? Yes. I think they would have to find a security guarantee of equal reliability and value to them, and I think that would be very tough to arrange, but maybe not impossible. But I certainly am not sanguine about the prospect of a rapid denuclearization. I think that's almost unthinkable because there's basically zero trust between the United States and North Korea.
Do you think that this summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump will actually take place?
Absolutely. I think it is almost certain to take place. Hiccups along the way are inevitable. They will argue over the agenda. They will argue over the meanings of words. That's normal. And when two countries meet at this level after such a long absence in high-level dialogue, there's bound to be a lot of uncertainty and posturing on the part of all sides. What we're seeing now, I think, is simply a normal North Korean behavior where they look at the situation and they're trying to seek whatever advantage they can. You've got a small, isolated, weak country dealing with a superpower. The superpower wants them to disarm and have faith that the superpower will not attempt to overthrow their government, not undermine them, not threaten their security. Well, that's a tall order, and I don't think Kim Jong-un is going to take anything from President Trump on faith. Both sides are going to have to prove that they're serious, and both sides are probably going to have to engage in a gradual, step-by-step, reciprocal exercise of confidence building, trust building, nuclear disarmament, and peace. And whether the Trump administration will have the patience for that, I don't know. Will the North Koreans lose confidence in it at some point along the way, as they have lost confidence in previous denuclearization agreements? I don't know. And although it's unlikely that North Korea will complete the process of denuclearization, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try.
All right. That's Frank Januzzi, president of the Mansfield Foundation. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A U.S. judge refuses to dismiss ex-Trump aide Paul Manafort's criminal case. At least 100 people have been kidnapped along a road in northern Nigeria. New U.S. sanctions target Iran's money transfers to Hezbollah. And Kenya steps into space with its first satellite launch. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thousands of Palestinian mourners gathered in Gaza Tuesday for the first of dozens of funerals for protesters killed in border clashes with Israeli security forces. Many of the mourners waved Palestinian flags and some called for revenge against Israel for the 60 who were killed and hundreds wounded on Monday. These mourners grieved for a baby that was killed by tear gas. New protests broke out along the Gaza border with Israel in the West Bank, with demonstrators hurling rocks at the Israelis and setting fires as Israeli forces fired tear gas in response. At least two more Palestinians were killed. But the number of protesters appeared to be substantially smaller than the 40,000 who demonstrated along the border Monday in opposition to the opening of the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, less than 100 kilometers away. United Nations human rights officials condemned the violence as appalling. But Nikki Haley, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., said Tuesday that Israel used restraint in response and blamed Gaza's ruling Hamas militant group for the violence.
Those who suggest that the Gaza violence has anything to do with the location of the American embassy are sorely mistaken. Rather, the violence comes from those who reject the existence of the State of Israel in any location. Such a motivation, the destruction of a United Nations member state, is so illegitimate as to not be worth our time in the Security Council, other than the time it takes to denounce it.
But the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights has condemned the killings and wounding of Palestinians by Israeli troops. At a news conference in Geneva, spokesman Rupert Colville described the events as appalling deadly violence. Colville spoke at a news briefing in Geneva Tuesday, urging an investigation into the events.
The rules on the use of force under international law have been repeated many times, but appear to have been ignored again and again. It seems anyone is liable to be shot dead or injured. Women, children, press personnel, first responders, bystanders, and at almost any point up to 700 meters from the fence.
Many U.S. allies, along with its foes, are expressing criticism of the U.S. decision to open its embassy in Jerusalem, saying it would increase tensions in the Middle East. South Africa has recalled its ambassador from Tel Aviv, while Turkey's government says it's recalling its ambassador to the U.S. for consultations over the U.S. embassy move. Joining us to discuss the situation is Robert Deitz, professor of the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University.
It just seems to me that this is kind of an excuse to create a riot.
It's an excuse by the Palestinians?
Yeah. I doubt whether the Israelis showed restraint. That tends not to be their modus operandi. They tend to respond to these things with serious force. And you can argue it from a strategic standpoint. You can argue that in both ways. But I doubt whether they're acting with complete restraint. But on the other hand, they're certainly going to defend their border against protesters trying, as I understand it, these were protesters attempting to break through the fencing to get into Israel.
I think that lethal force for someone crossing a border would certainly not be acceptable in this country.
Probably not, but we're not the size of Israel. If you could hypothesize 10,000, 20,000 Canadians surging across our northern border, what would our border patrol do? Obviously, it's a rhetorical question. My only point is that this strikes me as an excuse. U.S. make the capital, put your embassy in this disputed capital, and we in turn are going to surge across the border into Israel.
It certainly would seem that the peace process is all but dead.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more on that, but I think the peace process has been dead for years and years. And look, I'm not nominating Netanyahu for sainthood, but the Oslo Peace Accords, remember them, 20, 30 years ago? Offered the Palestinians a lot of what they had demanded, and ultimately the Palestinians rejected it.
Given the lives of the Palestinians and the struggles that they face,
yep.
Didn't moving that embassy, couldn't it have waited until there was some sort of agreement or something that maybe wouldn't have created even more hostility?
Sure, but there's also a counter argument. We've been horsing around with this so-called peace process for years and years and years. Nothing has come out of it. I mean, really, basically nothing has come out of it. So why not? And see if something now can...
How would that move things forward?
I don't know that it will, but it's very hard to see what the downside is. It's not like, oh my God, we are just on the cusp of creating this arrangement between Israel and Palestine. And
Well, the downside is that we've taken a side, and we're no longer able to be a neutral negotiator.
We've always had a side, no matter what people say. The fact is, we've always understood that Israel is the only democratic country in the Middle East, the only country that appears to have Western values. We were always been on their side. The reality is that Jerusalem, at least where, the Western part of Jerusalem is Israeli and is always going to be Israeli. I mean, to my mind, doing negotiations starts with having a realistic picture of what's actually happening. And I think this notion that somehow Jerusalem was up for negotiation was a chimera.
That's Robert Deitz, professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. We appreciate your perspective. European and Iranian foreign ministers in Brussels agreed to find answers to a series of key practical issues in the coming weeks to salvage the nuclear deal after the Trump administration's decision to pull out of it. From Paris, Lisa Bryant has more for VOA.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini said European and Iranian experts have already started meeting to hash out a series of challenges, from maintaining and deepening economic, transport, and financial relations to protecting European companies doing business with Iran. Despite some reported calls for a new or broader deal, Mogherini said on the table was the original agreement, as it was signed by six world powers in 2015.
If we want to save this deal, which is not an easy exercise, but if we want to save this deal, we know that the sooner we manage to do it, the better and the easiest it will be. Again, it will not be easy, but if I can use the metaphor that some raised around the table, we all have a relative in intensive care and we all want to get him or her out of the intensive care as soon as possible.
Mogherini spoke after talks between European foreign ministers and their Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif, on Tuesday. Washington's withdrawal has left many doubting whether Europe can save it, and the Europeans are now also looking for ways to protect their companies dealing with Iran from possible U.S. sanctions. Zarif said Tehran wants the EU to guarantee it will maintain all the benefits it has enjoyed under the deal. President Donald Trump said the agreement was insufficient in curbing Iran's nuclear program, Iran's role in Middle East conflicts, and addressing what happens after it expires. But Mogherini said the EU believes the nuclear deal should be considered separately from other areas of disagreement with Iran.
We are, and we've always been clear on this, there are more chances, more possibilities to open avenues for discussions with Iran on other issues if the Iranian deal stays in place, rather than not.
European leaders will be discussing the nuclear deal at a summit in Bulgaria that starts Wednesday. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
This is Russ Davis. Join me as I take you to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. for the induction of Joanne Brackeen, Diane Reeves, and Pat Metheny into the hallowed hall of NEA Jazz Masters, the 2018 NEA Jazz Masters on the next Jazz America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Britain's Prince Harry, sixth in line to the throne, and American Meghan Markle, best known for her former role in the TV drama Suits, are set to marry on Saturday in Windsor, England. For many fans, it's a fairy tale romance as a former American actress becomes a princess, and the marriage also breaks many of the unspoken conventions of the British royal family. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the day has added significance for many who watched Prince Harry grieve at the funeral of his mother, Princess Diana, 21 years ago, and who cites her as his continuing inspiration for the charitable work that he and Meghan will continue now as a couple.
A TV star and activist who has already made her mark on the world, Meghan Markle breaks the mold of the demure princess, says British royal expert Richard Fitzwilliams.
Meghan is an American biracial divorcee who's an activist, a feminist, and a former actress. Those were credentials that might well have barred her from marrying a senior member of the royal family only a relatively short time ago. Now they're being positively welcomed.
Welcomed into a British royal family that still elicits fascination around the world. Markle's activism mirrors the charitable work of her future husband.
In Rwanda and India and also in the United Nations for female empowerment, she's been an activist for much of her life. This is taking the world to a new level and she can lobby at the very top.
But that lobbying has a limit. Some fear Markle's outspoken nature may not go down well in the gilded corridors of a royal dynasty where politics is taboo.
The royal family does things quietly with dignity, and that's what we count on them for. So it's going to be very, I think, difficult for her to really curtail her activism. And we've seen a few stumbles here and there as she's been acclimating to royal life.
The couple met in 2016 and announced their engagement last November.
It's a standard, typical night for us.
It's a cosy night. What were we doing? Just roasting chicken
roasting
and having
a chicken. Trying to roast chicken.
Trying to roast a chicken. And it was just an amazing surprise. It was so sweet and natural and very romantic. He got on one knee.
For Britons, the wedding of Prince Harry will mark a particularly happy milestone.
This will be the royal wild child who has developed perhaps beyond levels that we thought he would.
The death of Princess Diana in a Paris car crash scarred a nation and deprived two young boys of their devoted mother. In recent years, Harry has described the mental trauma of the funeral.
It was an extraordinary experience. There's no doubt that he's had some deeply troubling times. The army has made him, and also it's very important to remember his commitment to charity.
Those twin passions have seen Prince Harry serve in Afghanistan and champion charitable causes around the world, including the Invictus Games for wounded servicemen and women.
Message? Yeah, from Michelle. How very amusing. So you realize to watch it together?
Yes.
Let's have a look.
Hey, Prince Harry, remember when you told us to bring it at the Invictus Games?
Careful what you wish for. Boom.
Oh, really? Please.
Boom.
Behind their transatlantic bond is plenty of compromise.
What we're seeing is quite the change. I mean, she's brought a California lifestyle to Britain. She's slimming him down. She's putting him on shakes, eating less meat. What Brit do you know that doesn't like meat?
The royal wild child tamed by the American star. Millions will tune in for the wedding. Many more will watch with fascination in the coming years as the new royal couple make their way in the world. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And by the way, Meghan Markle's father in a last-minute glitch may not be at the wedding. Thomas Markle is quoted as telling a celebrity website that he's scheduled to undergo heart surgery on Thursday. The new number one single is by a multi-talented singer-songwriter. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with all the details.
We are going to be checking out a brand new song from an actor, a singer, a songwriter, a man who has two identities. He's an Emmy winner from television's show Atlanta, and he's a Grammy winner for his hit song Redbone. His name is Donald Glover, or Childish Gambino. As a musician, as a singer-songwriter, he goes by the alias Childish Gambino, which he's used for several years. And earlier in the year, he had said that he's going to retire from music. Then all of a sudden, he signed a new publishing deal and said, nope, guess what? I'm not retiring from music. In fact, he's going out on tour this summer. Everybody's excited about it. And now he's got his very first number one hit song, following to Redbone, which was a Grammy winner, as I mentioned last year. This song is called This Is America. So let's give it a listen.
This is America. Don't got you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area.
My area.
I got the strap. I gotta carry them. Yeah, I'ma go into this.
Do you know how he got that name of Childish Gambino?
No, I have no idea. He doesn't talk about it. It's kind of an alter ego of his, and he jokes around a lot. In fact, he was the host slash musical guest of Saturday Night Live last weekend. He went on the show and he said, I'm going to be Donald Glover, the host, and I'm going to be Childish Gambino, the performer, which he was. He's got quite an illustrious past. If you look at all the awards he's gotten, the TV shows, he started off as a writer for 30 Rock, and then he went on to star on the show Community. And following that, he started to star in and co-write the FX hit show Atlanta, which I mentioned a little while ago, got an Emmy for his role there and Best Actor in a Television Series. And he's also going to be the voice of Simba opposite Beyonce in the action remake of A Lion King when it comes out in 2019. So he's going to be Simba. He's going to be the lead character. But right now, musically, his follow-up album, his last album, was called Awaken My Love, but he's working on a new album. This is the first song to come off of the new album. He hasn't released any information about it, other than I anticipate it'll be out in the summer, right around the time that he goes on tour, because that's typically what an artist does. They release an album, then go on tour to support the album. So the new song, This Is America, all about America, and it takes a look from a black man's perspective, because he refers to, you know, being a black man in the song several times. It's a very interesting song, debuting at number one, knocking Drake off the top of the charts.
It's pretty unusual to have someone who's a successful actor and a successful music artist as well. Very unusual.
And he's so talented, not only as an artist, but as a songwriter, too. He's a great writer, which we know from his TV and film days. I mean, People magazine have given him lots of props. He was on the Time magazine Most Influential People in the World issue. So he's one to watch. His star is on the rise, and he's been nothing but popular and successful since his debut in 2011. So we're looking forward to the new album, whatever it might be called. Whenever it might be coming out. I'm sure it'll be this summer.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The latest class of Lao public health workers, supported by the United States government, graduated from the Field Epidemiology Training Program in Vientiane on April 30th. Associate Professor Dr. Bun Kong Siavong, Minister of Health for the Lao People's Democratic Republic, commonly known as Laos, presented graduation certificates to the trainees at a ceremony, also attended by Michael Klein, Chargé d'Affaires of the U.S. Embassy, Dr. Shin Young Su, World Health Organization, or WHO, Regional Director for the Western Pacific, and Dr. Juliet Fleischel, WHO representative to Laos. The Field Epidemiology Training, or FET, program in Laos was initiated in 2009 and has trained more than 70 health workers who returned to their home provinces and implemented the latest techniques in detection, investigation, and response to known and emerging health threats across all 18 provinces of Laos. The program empowered health officials at all levels to use evidence-based approaches for decision-making in response to disease outbreaks in recent years, a process that is further strengthened as each new cohort of FET program graduates complete the training and return to their field assignments. FET graduates are recognized by senior public health officials at national and provincial levels for their technical competencies to support evidence-based decision-making, said Michael Klein, U.S. Chargé d'Affaires to Laos. One important factor in the program's effectiveness has been the participation of medical experts from a variety of ministries, which shows the interconnected ways that health threats can be detected and investigated, regardless of whether evidence of a new threat first appears in a local health clinic, at a border crossing or police station, or in an agricultural market where animals might show the first sign of an emerging threat. This is the ninth cohort of FET graduates supported by the U.S. government, said U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires Klein. This program clearly demonstrates our commitment to the Lao-U.S. Comprehensive Partnership and our support for building stronger ties between our two countries as Laos works to achieve its sustainable development goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Washington.